Hi, this is Jim from Safety Wars. Before we start the program, I want to make sure everyone understands that we often talk about OSHA and EPA citations, along with some other regulatory actions from other agencies, legal cases, and criminal activity. Everyone is innocent until proven guilty in a court of law. Proposed fines are exactly that, and they are often litigated, reduced, or vacated. We use available public records, news accounts, and press releases. We cannot warranty or guarantee the details of any of the stories we share, since we are not directly involved with these stories, at least not most of the time. Enjoy the show.
This show is brought to you by Safety FM.
And from the border of liberty and prosperity in the Highlands of the North, this is Safety Wars for Friday, January 17th, 2024. I'm saying 2025. I knew that was going to happen eventually. So, waiting for all these streamers to kick in here. And there was a problem. Okay, let's do this. Go live. All right, now it's saying it is live. All right, we're going to do it. We're going to go with it. Let's see what happens. I guess we went through a software update here on our OBS. Things look different. How's everybody doing? It's been a couple of days. Like I said, we had meetings this week, and we also had a couple of training classes this week for our clients. So we're in the deep freeze up here in the new metro New York, New Jersey area. And a lot of work is not going on outside. Next week, I had a whole bunch of projects canceled. Just too cold to work. We're expected. Well, first of all, Monday's a holiday. We plan on broadcasting Monday. And it's also inauguration day. Temperatures are predicted to be in single digits here in New York in the morning, getting up to a balmy like 19 degrees. Since all my projects have dust control on them, which is water. Water and that temperature really don't mix, especially, I used to work in a freezer in a warehouse in the summer for 2 summers, and then the third summer I was in the dairy section of Twin County Grocers, which is no longer in existence in Edison, New Jersey, on Talmadge Road. My brother and I passed by there the other day, and, you know, that's it may exist, but not there. But basically, no, it was so cold in the freezer section, the frozen food section of that warehouse, that you used to sweat, and guys used to do other things in there. And the minute any moisture or water hits the ground, what happens? Everything freezes. It's a horrible, horrible, horrible thing. I feel like one of the snowmen behind me here. Anyway, yes, they are seasonal. They're not Christmas. They are seasonal snowman now on display. Well, at the end of winter, we'll probably get rid of them. Anyway, put them back into storage. Anyway, I had a conversation this week with a listener, and she is going through a situation where she and I don't have permission to use her name. But she is giving a presentation next week, and she asked me if I knew anything about diving. And I said, yes, I do. Even though I am not a, and let me point this out right up front, I am not a diving guy. I am never, I have never been in anything, I've never even went snorkeling. So I know nothing on that end of it. However, several of my projects over the last 30-some years have had a diving element to it, and I've been responsible for overseeing as a controlling contractor for the controlling contractor, the overall safety for the site, which also included diving. And, even though I'm not a specific diver, I have to know. I had to know about diving. I had to know about the OSHA regulations and some of the other things. And in one situation, the dive supervisor, and no, this will sound familiar. The dive supervisor was out for the day, and they got a replacement dive supervisor, and he who had never been a dive supervisor on his own before. And someone got the bends, which were nitrogen bubbles in his blood, and had to go. We're talking way. Don't worry, you insurance people out there. This is way before JCP Technical or the company prior. And ended up getting the bends on the job, the guy. And I learned a whole hell of a lot. And it seems like a lot of these things keep going. I don't know, keep happening. Themes repeat. And the accident that we're talking about, she had asked me to talk about this accident from December 13th, 2024. We had discussed it here, but we're going to discuss it again, and we're going to go a little bit deeper into what the diving requirements are here. And let me point this out. I have discussed this with a couple of dive supervisors since last month when we covered this story, and I get the same theme from all of them. They all say, the conversation goes like this. Often what happens is people want to a career change, right? And they hear that commercial divers make a lot of money. They say, well, no, they make a lot of money. And they get these ideas in their head, a lot of these guys. Usually men, women normally don't do this. I'm sorry, guys. Women don't do this kind of stuff. And they go down and they get a and they become a recreational diver. Whatever education you need on that, they become a recreational diver. Then they say they find a company. Usually in the southeastern United States, maybe on the West Coast, or maybe the Caribbean, and they can hook up with a company or a person, and they say, you know what, I need something done underwater. It may be they got a contract to maybe rebuild the bulkhead, maybe they have to do some type of inspection, and they're going to send them down there with a camera, something you would think is relatively easy to do. Doesn't need a lot of training. And then before you know it, oh, I got away with this. Now I can do a little bit more. Now I can do a little bit more. Now I can. And before you know it, there's a problem. I don't know. We're going to discuss this story from North Carolina from last month. I don't know if that's what happened there, but this is one of the things that I hear about from people in the industry. Maybe they're telling you adjusting my headphones here. Maybe they're telling you, no, they like to talk. If they like to talk that much, they should come on to the program. Or maybe, you know, they want to act like they know something. I'm not going to go, like I said, I'm not a dive expert, but I can discuss the OSHA requirements and some of the questions that you have to ask as a safety professional, if you are overseeing this, or let's say that you are a manager and you're going to have divers on site. Now, this is often what happens. And I get a phone call. Hey, Jimmy, we're going to be doing a project. There is a diving aspect to the project. And do you know anything about diving? Yeah, I know this, I know this, I know this, I know this. I worked on them before as a controlling contractor, but I am not a diver. I am not a, or anything like that. So one of the questions right off the bat is, who are you getting to do the work? Are they certified commercial divers? Are they real commercial divers? Are they union? Are they non-union? Who are these folks and everything else? And has to be question number one, right? Or these guys like, oh, well, they're recreational divers. And it's like, well, look, I cannot tell you who to hire or not to hire, but I don't know if that's probably a good idea. then it's is a reputable company who's doing this. A couple of projects I've been on, there have been very small parts of the project have been diving. And what are they like? No, so you're a big diving company. You're going to come out with the setup time and everything else. No, divers, half of the time that they spend on site is setup time. Right? No, because they got to get a compressor. They have to get, and if they're on the water, it's even more. Right? The first day is all setup. Because they got to load the compressor, they got to load the equipment, they have to inspect the equipment, they have to do everything that they need to do with diving. It's like at least a half a day if it's on the land side, and maybe a day or more if you're on the water side, if they're going to be diving from the water. Some of the project, right, from like a boat or a barge or something like that. So you have to consider the setup time. And once they're there, they like to work. These folks like to work. Now they have switch outs and everything else. So normally you're looking at four people for diving. You may have a dive supervisor. You're going to have a tender. You're going to have a tender, right? Tending. You may have. You're going to have a backup diver, and you're going to have the actual diver doing the work. So right off the bat, if you only need one diver in the water, you're looking at four people. Some people get away with it with three, but you're generally speaking four people. If I'm wrong, I apologize, but this has been my experience with this. And as I point out, if you don't like being lied to, don't become a safety professional. Now, you have four people. You also have the equipment. Or is it going to be a bottle dive where you're going to be out of a bottle, a cascade system, or are you going to have an air compressor? The projects that I've been on, they have all been air compressors. Now, the question is this. Hazards of a breathing air compressor for diving is also the same as a regular breathing air compressor on the land. Let's say for a blast hood or level B setup. For a hazardous waste site. If you have a compressor, you have to worry about exhaust, like carbon monoxide, being sucked into the air compressor, into the breathing air supply, and with the diver. The accident that we're looking at here, that is likely what happened. Can't say yes or no. I wasn't there. I didn't do the investigation. And we know that sometimes the press releases may be accurate, may not be accurate. The accident reports may or may not be accurate. So, now take it for what it's worth. So, and then once you get carbon monoxide poisoning, how do you respond to it? And all of this has to be worked out ahead of time. So, you have to have a plan. You have to have first aid kit. You have to actually have advanced first aid on this, or an EMT level certification, not a licensed EMT, but you basically have to have an advanced first aid training of some sort. And then what are we going to do if the diver gets hurt? How are we going to get the diver out of the water? How's that going to happen? How are we going to get the diver to land? How are we going to get the diver transported to the hospital? Does the local EMT, and I'm not disparaging EMTs by any stretch of the imagination, do they actually have experience dealing with a diver? Do we have a facility near the job site, or what is the nearest facility that has an FDA-approved hyperbaric oxygen facility there. Hyperbaric oxygen facility there. Do they know what they're doing? Do they? Because right now there's three different types of hyperbaric facilities. Two are what you would normally see. They're a pressure chamber. You're putting your body under pressure there. And it could be either one or more people, and one is just for one is for one or more people. And then you have what is often found at the wound care center, which is a plastic bag. Dead serious. Somewhere there's a picture of my old man in one of these things when he needed to go in for some wound care type stuff after some surgery. So that's all in there. Same thing if you're on any other job. So we were on a project in Colorado, regular construction job. There's a hospital across the street. There was an injury on the job, very potentially serious injury. And we were thinking, oh, thank God, the hospital's right across the street. The ambulance came, they said, we can't go to that hospital. We got to go to this hospital. They don't treat this kind of injury here. I told a story here already where my brother was in a hospital, my brother John, and this is a number of years ago, and he's in the emergency room and for a situation and in a long line, and one of the nurses comes out and says, has anybody here ever delivered a baby? My brother's like, and then they and this nurse says, yeah, I delivered one time, and she said, well, you're in charge, because that hospital was not for the type of hospital you go to deliver a baby. They weren't really set up for it. Did they? Were they successful? Everything turned out right? Yeah, as far as I know, everything went well. But nobody there, including the doctors on duty, had ever delivered a baby. So, you know, it's one of those things. Now, we're going to take a brief commercial break, and we're going to come back with this, I'm going to do the share screen and everything else.
Warning, the following broadcast contains adult language, adult content, frank safety discussions, and stories that might sound unbelievable. But believe me, every one of those stories is true. We didn't start the safety war, but we are going to fight to win it. For our families, for our communities, for our workplaces, and for our lives.
Hard hat on my head, set the alarm. High voltage love in your arms. Steel toe boots, steal my heart. Now love's a machine, start to start. Danger signs, but we don't mind. We're safety certified. Hearts aligned, locked out, tagged out, hearts entwined. You and me, we're one of a kind. Fire extinguisher, spark of desire. Emergency exits, this love's on fire. Hard hat and real, yeah, we comply. Our love's as strong as reinforced supply. Our love's like gears, it turns so true. Turbines of passion spinning with you. Mechanical love, it's built to last. Safety first, romance moving fast. Romance, it's OSHA approved. Love that's steady, never misused. Red tape barriers can't keep us apart. Love evolves safety from the start. Dangerous signs, but we don't mind. We're safety certified. Hearts aligned. Locked out, tagged, our hearts entwined. You and me, we're one of a kind. Worksite romance, it's OSHA approved. Love that's steady, never misused. Red tape barriers can't keep us apart. Love evolves safety from the start. Worksite romance, it's OSHA approved. Love that's steady, never misused. Red tape barriers can't keep us apart. Love evolves safety from the start.
Is your safety training old, stale, and hackneyed? Is your safety trainer still preaching a warped version of behavior-based safety? How about safety training that is designed to actually address and assess your hazards and liabilities and is not standardized baloney from generations ago? Contact the Safety Wars team at safetywars.com or call me, Jim Polzel, at 845-269-5772. Remember, if you are receiving this message, you are the solution to unsafe workplaces. OSHA recordables, catastrophic losses, environmental disasters. You want answers? So do I. This is Jim Polzel with Safety Wars.
That's my daddy!
From the front lines of the safety war, it's Safety Wars. With your host, Jim Polzel on Safety FM. Get ready to face the harsh reality.
And we are back here, facing the harsh reality. I didn't realize that was a full song there. Usually it's just a one-minute clip, so... That was Safety Warrior with Love in the Safety Zone. All royalty free, folks. Mann's Harbor, North Carolina. This is a story out of from December 13, 2024. U.S. Department of Labor finds contractor safety failures led to diver's preventable fatality at an underwater worksite at Mann's Harbor Bridge. So this is Mann's Harbor, North Carolina. A Maryland-based construction contractor could have prevented a 47-year-old diver from suffering fatal injuries during an underwater dive test in June 2024 at the Mann's Harbor Bridge on Croton Sound. Investigators with OSHA learned a four-member dive team employed by a certain company was doing an underwater test on the worker's first day of work. Seconds after descending from a boat to about 19 feet underwater, the diver became unresponsive. Once the diver failed to answer radio calls, the other dive team members responded by removing the diver from the water. Co-workers assisted in getting the employee out of the water and performed CPR while waiting for emergency personnel to arrive. Despite these efforts, the employee could not be revived. OSHA's investigators identified several safety deficiencies at the site, including the company's failure to assess workers' fitness for diving and ensure first aid supplies and a manual resuscitator were available on site. In addition, the company improperly positioned an air intake to prevent contamination and did not perform regular air purity tests on compressor systems and test the air hose pressure annually. And this is a quote from OSHA Area Office Director Kim Morton in Raleigh, North Carolina. Ensuring employees are physically fit for commercial diving is a fundamental part of workplace safety. Employers have a duty to protect their workers by implementing strict safety protocols and thorough pre-employment evaluations, particularly in high-risk industries like commercial diving. This tragic incident could have been prevented. OSHA cited the company for four serious violations and proposed a whopping, $40,329 in penalties, the maximum OSHA can legally recommend. This is right off of the website here, right? OSHA's press release. The company has 15 days from the receipt of its citations and penalties to comply, request an informal conference with OSHA's area director and contest the findings going on and on and on. We all know the process here. Based in Cambridge, Massachusetts, the company has provided Based in Cambridge, Maryland, the company has provided structural shotcrete services for commercial, industrial, energy, and public sectors clients and has built, maintained, rehabilitated concrete structures since 1983. The company employs divers for marine operators to perform infrastructure construction, maintenance, and repair. So employers can also contact the agency for information about OSHA's compliance assistance resources, blah, 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 including industries as maritime. Unfortunately, I don't know why they threw maritime in there. As I see it, maritime is a shipyard, a marine terminal, or longshoring. OSHA 1915, 1917, and 1918 standards, 29 CFR, right? 1926 is construction. What they were doing here is the commercial diving standard is what applies here. and also Coast Guard things and industry standards and things of that nature. But the OSHA Maritime Standard does not apply here. This would be either, and it turns out 1910, right, was what they were cited under, or 1926 construction, which would also include marine construction. So I don't get it, but that's fine. What OSHA has said in its field operation manual, I believe it's chapter 2, that if a vertical standard, you don't have a standard in a particular area, then you have to go to the general industry one with that. So let's take a look and see what we have here. And I'm going to remind everybody, all of these people are innocent until proven guilty. Things are litigated, vacated, negotiated downward, and everything else with this. And you can find out more. Give us a call, 845-269-5772. We will be in the new year sometime putting together a introduction to OSHA class online, but I can do it in person too. Give me a call. And here we go. And this is all the front matter. So if you're not used to seeing this, or if you're a new listener or viewer to the program, we always go through the OSHA and EPA website, and we get basically, this is all non-copyrighted, open source here with all of these reports that I read. It's all open source here. And they give you a letter, a nice letter, and they tell you you have to post it, and then they tell you you have to have an informal contest, and you have a right to contest, and then you have a penalty payment, and it's basically all the same here. And it gives, and you have to let your employees know, and you have an abatement certification of corrective action or abatement on there. And then here we go. Citation 1, and then it gives you the citation and proposed penalties. These are all proposed. Type of violation, serious. This is 29 CFR 1910-420A. The employer shall develop and maintain a safe practices manual, which shall be made available at the dive location to each dive team member. On or about June 25th, 2024, the employer did not maintain a safe practices manual at the work site to address the safety and health of employees who were engaged in diving operations. Now, it is saying corrected during inspection. I don't know how you go from not maintaining one. Maybe it wasn't complete. Maybe it wasn't filled out. Who the confident, right? The lines authority, and who's responsible for what? Something like that. That's what I suspect. Because I look at these dive manuals. Some of them are cheesy, 4 or 5 pages. Some are extremely comprehensive with that. So I suspect that perhaps roles and responsibilities, something like that, site address was not in the manual. They were able to correct it. So fine, $4,839. So that is a serious violation. This here we have citation 1, item 2A. Type of violation, serious. 29 CFR 1910.421C1. A first aid kit appropriate for the diving operation and approved by a physician shall be available at the dive location. That means you have to have a medical consultant that is able to, who knows about diving. So they did not have a first aid kit available. $8,067 is proposed. Now let me comment a little bit on this. Under the regular OSHA regulations and out there, if you cannot supply a medical response within 4 minutes, 3 to 4 minutes, somewhere in there, then you have to have people on site who are first aid and CPR trained, not AED training yet, right? And there are issues with that. We're not going to go. That's out of the scope of this program that we're doing tonight. And they have ANSI requirements for first aid kits. And the ANSI requirements are pretty specific, and you get that, and you have that on site, and you have it. And I always tell people, get two. Don't get one first aid kit. Get two first aid kits. And you have one available in the meeting area, in the central location. And then you have one that is, like, available that people who are in charge, persons in charge, know is there. The reason being, how many times do you think they end up ransacking the first aid kit that's out in the open? Happens all the time. And that's why you have to do a weekly documented inspection of those things to, or more, if it's appropriate, to verify you have the right stuff. And this goes for this here. So in the diving world, you have to have a first aid kit approved by a physician. I would, and hopefully it's a physician that knows what to do with diving. Not your standard pediatrician, unless a pediatrician has experience in diving. Not what I often see, where a person gets hurt and they and it's a male, someone who is a biological male, and they get a note that they got hurt from a gynecologist. That does say it's not going to work. And I know people are thinking you're crazy, Jim, but this is the kind of stuff that happens out there. Especially with companies who do not have medical people set up ahead of time, a medical consultant. And if you want to know of a good one, give us a call at 845-269-5772. If you want to sponsor a program and you're a medical consultant, give us a call at that same number. Citation 1, item 2B, type of violation serious. This is grouped together with the previous one, so the inspection is zero, and this was corrected during inspection. This sounds like something that you could, right, run out and get a first aid kit, or maybe someone has one in the car or truck or something. I always carry a full-blown first aid kit plus some. In addition to any other first aid supplies, an American Red Cross standard first aid handbook or equivalent, and a bag type manual resuscitator with transparent mask and tubing shall be available at the dive location. On or about blah blah blah, employees performing diving operations were exposed to a drowning hazard, and that an American Red Cross standard first aid handbook or equivalent and a bag type manual resuscitator with transparent mask and tubing was not maintained at the work site. Now, let me point this out. If you had first aid CPR training, we give you a manual. In every first aid kit out there, that's out there for many, right, there is also a manual in there. Why is that? In an emergency, people can blank out. Yes, they can blank out. I was on a job, and we were putting on hard hat stickers on the hard hats with the emergency numbers for that job. It was not 911 or 911 if you're from a rural area. I'm only joking. 911. It was a site-specific emergency number. That number, we had a real serious injury on site. And what ended up happening was, I mean, this is many, many years ago. What happened was everybody forgot the emergency number. And then I said, no, it's on your hard hat. Call that number on the hard hat. So we were doing that. So the same thing could probably happen to a normal person. Now, if you're an EMT, I hope that you know what's going on and you're able to write without a book. But that's just for that, right? And the other thing is, make that into a safety meeting, you could. Citation 1, item 3, dive team assignments, and they got whacked them for the maximum here. And let's remember, the OSHA citations are going up, went up just now. Dive team assignments and physical fitness of dive team members, including any impairment known to the worker. So that has to be listed, right? So the employer did not assess the fitness of the diver engaged in diving operations. Now, one of the accidents that I was involved in, I wasn't involved in the accident, but there was an accident I had to investigate and everything else. What happened was the person His lifelong dream was to become a commercial diver. And he was, how can I say this? He went and became a commercial diver with a certain union. And he went out and there was a doctor that was known. Now the doctor is no longer with us. He passed away, and he's out of business right after this happened. He didn't do diving stuff. What ended up happening, diving physicals, he was well known to accept payments off the book. And this gentleman had developed a medical condition. He was about 24, 25 years old, that range. And he developed a medical condition which would normally preclude you from diving. And it put you at a higher risk of the bends and some other issues that we're going to go into here. And what he ended up doing was he wanted to be a diver. This was his dream. So he went out and he paid this doctor. The doctor said, everything is wonderful. And he ended up going out and getting the bends. And we'll follow up with that story, what ended up happening. And again, I was very young on this job. I knew nothing about diving. They said, look, you got a dive supervisor. He's handling everything. And I said, okay. And they said, look, you're not a diver. Ask questions, but, you know, he's in charge. No problem. They got a separate safety person. No problem at all. And, so this is where this is one of the issues is you have to get a qualified medical person. On the other end, you have the other situation where in the normal workplace, you have a situation with people sending people to literally, like I said, gynecologists and everything for workplace injuries. And they're men, biological males, and there's a situation here. What do? You have to have a qualified person. How many of us have told that to our employers or our clients, and they don't do it, and then everything ends up becoming an OSHA recordable? Yeah, right. So that was 16,131, the maximum. Here we have a citation 1, item 4A, type of violation series. Air compressor intakes shall be located away from areas containing exhaust or other contaminants. All right, so employees performing diving operations were exposed to possible air contaminants in the air intake, in that the air intake was close in proximity to the compressor exhaust. So if you go to Bering Sea Gold, I believe it was the season finale of season 3, you had actual divers. Showing actual divers that got carbon monoxide poisoning. One was a diver, one was not a diver while diving. And I showed this during a carbon monoxide safety course, session, I should say. It was a course, it was a session. And immediately we had a guy go out and do that and try to poison his coworker. And the company wouldn't fire him because it was the shop steward. Right on that, they had a dispute. But anyway, I digress. But for whatever reason, often the dive compressors do not have an inline carbon monoxide detector. They say that they are not required to have it, and they have all this other stuff. I think that probably are required to have it, and that's usually an email if they don't have it. Why don't you have a carbon monoxide detector on that? And because, again, you can, even with a breather box, and there are many types of breather boxes where you hook up to a regular air compressor, filter the air, and make it into breathing air, you can't filter out carbon monoxide. So what ends up happening is you have to have a CO monitor on there. It's just like a hydrogen sulfide monitor in the refining industry with that as part of your PPE. Looks like we're going to go overtime here. We'll be on Rumble and YouTube after Safety FM. Citation on item 4B, the output of air compressor system shall be tested for air purity every 6 months by means of samples taken at the connection to the distribution system, except that non-oil lubricated compressors need not be tested for oil mist. Honor, the employer did not test the roll air compressor systems for air purity for over 6 months, thereby exposing employees to the possibility of contaminated air compressor systems for air purity for over 6 months, thereby exposing employees to the possibility of contaminated air. Zero fine on that one. Citation 1, item 4C, $0 on this one. Breathing gas supply hose are not tested at least annually to 1.5 times their working pressure. Right, so thus, thereby exposing divers to a drowning hazard at 19 feet. Citation 2, item 1, type of violation other than serious. All dive team members shall be trained in CPR and first aid, American Red Cross standard or equivalent. We do that teaching here, 845-269-5772. On or about June 25th, 2024, several employees performing dive operations did not maintain current CPR or first aid training. $0. Citation 2, item 2. Other than serious, emergency aid. A list shall be kept at the dive location of the telephone or call numbers of the following. Again, you have to have this. Accessible hospitals, available physicians, available means of transport, and the nearest U.S. Coast Guard Rescue Corps U.S. Coast Guard Rescue Coordination. $0. Citation 2, item 3, other than serious. The following information shall be recorded and maintained for each diving operation. On or about June 25th, 2024, the employer did not record or maintain the following information for each diving operation. One, and I'm going through all of this here, right? The names of the dive team members, including the designated pick, person in charge, dive date, time, and location, diving modes used, general nature of the work performed, approximate underwater and surface conditions, meaning the visibility, water temperature, and current, and the maximum depth and bottom time for each diver. The reason why you need that is to figure out if they had need to go through a decompression procedure on that, and we'll be talking about that. So what do you think? Everybody following along? I hope so. All right. And here, so now we're going to jump on over to the regulation. Let's see how this pans out here. Hold on. Okay. So this is right off of OSHA.gov. So we are in 1910 subpart T, commercial diving operations. That is 1910.40 on scope and application. Always look, one of your number one questions when looking at the regulations is, does this actually apply to me? And it says, no, this is... This applies to every place of employment within the waters of the United States and within any state, District of Columbia, going on and on and on. This standard applies to diving and related support operations conducted in connection with all types of work and employments, including general industry, construction, ship repairing, ship building, ship breaking, and longshoring. However, this standard does not apply to any diving operations, and they have exemptions here where it doesn't apply, and it's rather extensive, but rest assured, it applied in this situation. Here. And here we have application in emergency. An employer may deviate from the requirements in the standard to the extent necessary to prevent or minimize a situation which is likely to cause death, serious physical harm, or major environmental damage, provided that the employer notifies the area director of OSHA within 48 hours, right? And there's some requirements there. And upon request from the area director, submits such information in writing, the employer shall be responsible with compliance of everything here, right, with this. So let's jump on back. Definitions, and you have your definitions section here with everything. We're not going to go through every one of these because it's, not in there. Qualifications of the dive team. Each dive team member shall have the experience or training necessary to perform assigned tasks in a safe and healthful manner. Each dive team member shall have experience or training in the following: the use of tools, equipment, and systems, techniques of the assigned diving mode, and diving operations and emergency procedures. All dive team members shall be trained in CPR and first aid, and dive team members who are exposed to or control the exposure of others to hyperbaric conditions shall be trained in diving-related physics and physiology. So, in other words, you got to know your shit to do this work. Real simple. Now, let's see if there's any... now, there's no letters of interpretation here. And you have to have a designated person in charge here, and or a.k.a. dive supervisor. Safe practices manual. The employer shall develop and maintain a manual which shall be made available at the dive location to each dive team member. Contents. The safe practices manual shall contain a copy of this standard and the employer's policies for implementing the requirements of this standard. And it goes on and on. And this is all simple and basic stuff on here. The thing that they failed at here, it looks like emergency procedures for fire, equipment failure, adverse environmental conditions, medical illness, and injury. And then you have different requirements here for this. Looks like it was surface area supply diving, right, since it had a compressor. And each diver shall be continuously tended while in the water. A diver shall be stationed at the underwater point of entry when diving is conducted in enclosed or physically confining spaces. Each diving operation shall have a primary breathing gas supply sufficient to support divers for the duration of the planned dive. For dives deeper than 100 feet per FSW, I forget what that is, or outside the no decompression limits, a separate dive team member shall tend each diver in the water, and it goes on and on with that. Again, very comprehensive. And you have record recording requirements here. The employer shall record the occurrence of any diving-related injury and illness, which requires any dive team member to be hospitalized for 24 hours or more, specifying the circumstances of the incident and the extent of any injuries and illnesses. Now, we have nothing here, right? Stuff in the Federal Register here. But this is basically is the same as the regular record-keeping requirements here. And upon the request of the Assistant Secretary of Labor for Occupational Safety and Health, or Director, National Institute for Occupational Safety and Health, and other people, right, the employer shall make available for inspection and copying any record or document required by the standard. My only question is this. Is that the four-hour limit, the 4 hours that you have to show it or not? I would assume that it is on that. And if you don't have it, you had better have it in that time period. You better have a very damn good excuse. That's all I have to say. Because they don't buy it. They don't, you know. And again, recording of the dives, any injuries, any illnesses, anything like that. So that's what we have on that. Now, here we have, they talk about decompression chambers here, or what they call hyperbaric chambers. I'm going to be reading off, this is off of the Mayo Health, Mayo Clinic website. I cannot share that because it's copyrighted here, but no, we're using this under fair use. We could use under fair use and commentary here. So hyperbaric oxygen therapy increases delivery of oxygen to the body by providing pure oxygen in an enclosed space with a higher than normal air pressure. So it basically forces the air into you. Hyperbaric oxygen therapy treats a condition called decompression sickness that's caused by rapid drops in water pressure in scuba diving or air pressure in air or space travel. Other conditions treated with hyperbaric oxygen therapy include serious injuries, serious tissue disease or wounds, trapped air bubbles in blood vessels, carbon monoxide poisoning, we're going to talk a little about that, and tissue damage from radiation therapy. Now, there are 14 different things that this is approved for. So, it's approved for a life-saving treatment. Hyperbaric oxygen therapy can save the lives of people who have air bubbles in their blood vessels, decompression sickness, carbon monoxide poisoning, serious trauma causing blocked blood flow. Limb-saving treatment, the therapy can, right, because it manages infections of tissues or bone that cause tissue death, non-healing wounds such as a diabetic foot ulcer, tissue-saving treatment. The therapy can help with the healing of skin grafts or skin flaps at the risk of tissue death, tissue and skin grafts after burn injuries, tissue damage from radiation therapy. And the therapy may also be used to treat pus-filled pockets in the brain called brain abscesses, low counts of red blood cells from serious blood loss, sudden hearing loss from unknown cause. I didn't know that. Sudden vision loss from blocked blood flow to the retina. And I'm sure that there are other things. And this therapy does have a lot of side effects. One of them is when we had an injury where the guy got the bends, which I just did before, I described before, with the person with the falsified medical records. We went in there and it was, we got to the hot facility in the middle of a cycle that was like 5 or 6 hours long. So we had to wait like 2.5 hours to get in there. And then he was in there for like 2 to 3 hours. So by the time he got out of there, he was so freaking hungry, it wasn't even funny. Right? But the thing is, you have to plan this out ahead of time. Now, there are a couple of different hyperbaric chambers here with this. All right? Couple of different ones. One of them is, let's see, can I get a picture here that's not copyrighted? Hold on, I might be able to do that. No. All right. So there are three different types. And one of them is, one type is, you're going to laugh when I tell you this, and this is very common, is that is basically a glorified plastic bag that you go in and it's under pressure and you breathe oxygen. It's slightly pressurized. That is not approved for really anything here, right? So with that, so you have medical, one thing is a medical grade chamber. You have a monoplace hyperbaric chamber. And it basically looks like, if you've ever seen a sci-fi movie here, that they put people into stasis, right? On there, and you know, they put the, and you put them in basically a big tube that's sealed on both ends. And that is a monoplace HVOT chamber, what they call it, and it's for one person. You could also have a multiplace hyperbaric chamber. This is one that we treated the person that I talked about before in, and that is a, you have room for like 4 or 5 people in there. A little bit of trivia for you. You can't go in there with electronics because it will destroy electronics being under pressure there. And then you have a mild hyperbaric chamber, which is also known as a soft hyperbaric chamber. Also bags made of polyurethane or canvas material. These chambers reach a much lower pressure and only compress room air, which contains 21% oxygen versus 100% medical-grade oxygen used in traditional medical-grade hyperbaric chambers. These are not to be used, these are not designed to be used with oxygen. Despite these key differences, soft chambers are often marketed as effective as medical-grade chambers in a host of conditions, even if these claims have not been studied or proven. So, buyer beware. I know that these are sometimes available where people have them at home. We were actually looking at that. This was the treatment my father had, And we were actually looking to get a home one because I saw an advertiser for a home one. I said, how much is it? Blah, blah, blah. Didn't make sense because insurance paid for one and not the other with that. And with the other one, you can see why they don't. Insurance companies don't want that is because it's not what you know that'll. It's not when people say, hey, I don't know how to do this. That's the problem. It's when people say, I know how to do this and I don't know anything. Right? That's the problem. Going on, now, there is a U.S. Navy has a diving manual, very, very comprehensive, almost 1,000 pages that covers this stuff. And if you look into chapter 17 of that manual, it goes into comprehensive descriptions of how to treat people. What's the title of this chapter? It is Recompression Diagnosis and the Treatment of Decompression Sickness and Arterial Gas Embolism. And it's like in depth and detailed, which means you need to really know what you're doing to supervise this and to be involved with the work. It's not like okay, you know, like I doubt a recreational diver would know this. Is what I'm told on this. With this, so again, we're in the Metro New York City area. There's only a couple of these facilities, a couple of hospitals with that. So I always make sure. First question I get on site with these divers: what place are you using? Where's the dive manual? And it's like, well, blah, 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 blah. Okay. It's very frustrating, right? And then it's like, oh, you know something? Well, no, nothing bad ever happens. Because this is the other thing. If you get the, I'm told that once you get the bends, no one will hire you again. At a lot of companies, you'll never get another medical certification to do that. So, so what am I saying? There's an incentive not to report problems. Does that sound familiar to any of you safety people out there? So we're heading the end of the program for Safety FM. I'm going to take a break real quick here. And we are going to have the outro here on our patriotic music at the end. How many more minutes do we have? We're down to 2 minutes, and we are going to put on our patriotic music, and we will see you at the end of that. So here we go. Share. Again, share a screen. And we're put on some more music from Safety Warrior. Not that long, though.
The views and opinions expressed on this podcast are those of the host and its guest and do not necessarily reflect the official policy or position of the company. Examples of analysis discussed within this podcast
we'll see everybody
are only
on Rumble.
They should not be utilized in the
YouTube
real world as the only solution available, as they are based only on very limited and dated open source information. Assumptions made within this analysis are not reflective of the position of the company. No part of this podcast may be reproduced, stored in a retrieval system, or transmitted in any form or by any means, mechanical, electronic, recording, or otherwise, without prior written permission of the creator of the podcast, Jay Allen.
Warning, the following broadcast contains adult language, adult content, frank safety discussions, and stories that might sound unbelievable. But believe me, every one of those stories is true. We didn't start the safety war, but we are going to fight to win it. For our families, for our communities, for our workplaces, and for our lives.
And here we are, back for hour two of Safety Wars. We're talking about diving. So for those of you who are just tuning in for hour two, we had a request from a listener basically to go over diving stuff. They are delivering a presentation on something that includes diving, and they say, you know what? Let's hear about diving. I know that there was an accident recently, that sort of thing. Let's go to it. So we're going to continue with this. We reviewed the accident in the first hour, and we are going to continue here. And we left off with hyperbaric chamber stuff in the U.S. diving table here, the U.S. Navy diving table. I'm going to do a share screen here of this. And here, I can turn off Safety FM. I'm not on there. So the first hour is live if you're new to the program on Safety FM, typically. Not all the time. And we broadcast between 3 to 5 times a week. And normally our second hour is politics. But we're not doing that today. With that, I'm sure there's going to be a lot to talk about this weekend. And if I could ask you to just check out our program, like and subscribe it on whatever social media platform you're on, whether it's Facebook under Safety Wars and JCP Technical Services, if it's on YouTube, Skylander 52 or JCP Technical Services, Rumble, X under Skylander 52 and Safety Wars. All the links are available on our website at safetywords.com. And also, we often upload to Brighteon also. So we have a lot of options. And, you know, it gets frustrating because we... I can't find you. I hear this from family members. Well, first, you have my phone number. And second, I'm not exactly hard to find. So we have the U.S. Navy dive manual here, and it's close to 1,000 pages. And, I mean, it covers all different types of stuff, including the treatment. And I'm going to scroll on down here. So this is an example. We're going to go to everything that you need. Now, what I would so normally the medical facility that has one of the actual approved medical chambers, my experience, they know this section 17 like the back of their hand, because also here you have a treatment table here where it gives you a treatment table 5 depth time profile, and it gives you a table on what to do here with this. This is why it's important. How deep was the water? That's going to dictate how much time you're going to be in here. And here we have our treatment table number 6, the depth and time profile. How long were you under? What's the time? I'm not going to even pretend to go into this, because the last thing I need is someone to say, Jimmy Pozel told me X, Y, and Z. Right? And my insurance agent will beat me up. Or at least give me a good stern talking to here. Treatment table 7, depth and time profile, and going on. Now, when you come down here, it also tells you... how to construct one of these things, the specifications, and I am looking. Let me do a find on here because it gives you treatment guidelines for different types of physical injuries. So I believe it was in here. Let me scroll through here real quick. I'm sorry, folks at home. They're watching this. Different calculations are in here. Ventilation, chamber maintenance. And I have a feeling that if you are in charge of one of these things, often these dive sites have their own decompression chamber. Again, having qualified people, and they probably use this book as a checklist. Here. Okay. Anyway, you can look it up yourself on here, but realize that there's a very, this is the U.S. Navy diving manual. They all seem to, and I could be wrong on this, maybe that's just a facility I'm familiar with, where they go into how to use it. They have this. I have multiple copies of this book here on there. So here's something else here. Lost the page number. Now, I mentioned carbon monoxide here. Carbon monoxide poisoning. This is another situation where carbon monoxide is used for treatment of that. And when I give carbon monoxide training, right, when I cover this as a topic, I go through the procedures. I'm not a doctor. I don't play one on TV, but I could read a book and I can present the information here. It's a complete and total nightmare to get treatment for this. And often I'm going to tell you, and I am not a doctor. I don't play one on TV or the radio. Oftentimes the EMTs are not familiar with this. Paramedics are. And depending on where you are in the country, they're not used to treating this. They may not know how. So number one, if you're in an area where you think that's the case, now you really have to focus on prevention. You should be focusing on prevention to begin with, preventing carbon monoxide. That's what we do as safety professionals. But often what people say, and you get this for cuts, well, if I cut my finger, I got a first aid kit. I get hurt, the hospital's down the street. Well, is it the appropriate hospital? If I do this, hey, it's not a big deal. With carbon monoxide, people don't really realize how dangerous it is and how to treat it. Now, how do you get carbon monoxide poisoning? In well-ventilated areas, carbon monoxide is not a cause for concern. When carbon monoxide is present in large quantities, amounts in relatively airtight spaces, it can build up and become dangerous quickly. All right. So what are you talking about? Faulty gas stoves and appliances such as clothes dryers, space heaters, or fireplaces, wood-burning fireplaces, faulty water heaters, old or faulty furnaces that burn gas, oil, coal, or wood, clogged chimneys, outdoor fuel burning or gas-powered appliances used indoors. Outdoor activities can create carbon monoxide hazards. So, for example, it often happens where people are with landscapers working on the outside of a building. The exhaust goes into the building, and you get indoor air quality issues. How long does it take? How long does carbon monoxide poisoning take? Low levels, up to 2 hours. What are the symptoms? Shortness of breath, dizziness, becoming nauseated, getting a headache, and feeling confused. So what happens is that the carbon monoxide displaces oxygen in your blood. And you run into issues. You get basically chemical asphyxiation with it. And going on long-term problems, it's critical to treat carbon monoxide quickly. Timely treatment may reverse harmful side effects depending on how long you were exposed and how much carbon monoxide you took in. You may have long-term health issues. And there's a whole list here I'm not going to go into because, again, I am not going to put this out there with this. You can look it up here. So, again, with people that are higher risk are pregnant women and the baby, babies, smokers, people who live at a high altitudes, people older than 65, and people with anemia. Certain jobs place you at risk. So what do you do? Generally speaking, you move the person away from the area exposed to carbon monoxide. Again, we have detectors in the house. That's a requirement now. If the person is unconscious, check for injuries before moving. Turn off the source of carbon monoxide if it's safe. Call 911 or 911. Begin cardiopulmonary resuscitation if necessary. If the person is unresponsive, breathing abnormally or not breathing, perform CPR for 1 minute before calling 911 if you are alone. Otherwise, have someone else call it and begin CPR. For a child, start CPR for children. Again, for children, first thing, then you call 911. Continue CPR until the person begins breathing or emergency help arrives. What is the treatment? Mild poisoning is treated with oxygen delivered by a mask. Severe carbon monoxide poisoning may require placing the person in a full-body high-pressure chamber to help force oxygen in the body. With mild exposure, the effects may begin to wear off as soon as you inhale fresh air or pure oxygen. It may take up to a day for the carbon monoxide to leave your body completely. You may still feel symptoms until it clears for up to 2 weeks after you've had it. Now, I've spoken to a family member who got carbon monoxide poisoning back in the 60s and 1960s. He's going to do the numbers. He's elderly now. And basically what he said was when he had it, now anytime that he smells, ever since then, anytime that he smells exhaust, he has to vomit and everything else. So it was a lifelong thing, especially for what he does for a living. And you could go anywhere, a lot of places online on where to put the carbon monoxide detectors and everything else out with that. Now, we're going to run through the carbon monoxide safety data sheet real quick. Again, this is copyrighted, so I can't really go into it. But here we have carbon monoxide. One of the things is it's odorless in its pure form here. So not smelling exhaust does not mean that you do not have carbon monoxide. You do not have a carbon monoxide situation. So you have exposure limits. You have the California PEL, permissible exposure limit of 25 parts per million for 8 hours, the ceiling limit of 200 parts per million, ACGIH TLV of 25 parts per million for 8 hours, OSHA PEL, the vacated ones from 1989, the TWA was 35 ppm, and the ceiling level was 200 ppm. The NIOSH REL recommended exposure limit is 35 ppm for 10 hours, and the ceiling limit is 200 ppm. The OSHA PEL is 50 parts per million, right, because that never really got updated. Now, I include those because what are you going to need to deal with and manage carbon monoxide avoidance and eliminating the problem, like with the hierarchy of controls, obviously is the most important thing you need to do. It's a given, number one. Number two, if there is no respirator that you for carbon monoxide protection except for supplied air. So you need that, right? Avoidance. If you need a respirator, supplied air. But how do you determine whether you need that? You need air sampling. or air monitoring with this. And with an air monitoring device, you need it meets certain requirements, and it has to be calibrated and everything else. It's not like you go down to your local department store and get a carbon monoxide detector and say, well, this is what we're going to hang our hat on. Those are designed, those take have a very slow response time, and those are not designed for the workplace if you're going to measure for air monitoring and things of that nature. So that's all I have. We ran a little overtime here, an hour and 16 minutes and 29 seconds. And I will, that's it. That's what we got. I will, I have to go back to work now. Right? This ain't working. I enjoy doing this. I plan on being on once this weekend, at least. And I will be uploading this as soon as I can, probably sometime tomorrow afternoon. So for Safety Wars, this is Jim Polzel, and we're going to go to our outro, and good night. See you later on. Oh, wrong one.
The views and opinions expressed on this podcast are those of the host and its guest and do not necessarily reflect the official policy or position of the company. Examples of analysis discussed within this podcast are only examples. They should not be utilized in the real world as the only solution available, as they are based only on very limited and dated open source information. Assumptions made within this analysis are not reflective of the position of the company. No part of this podcast may be reproduced, stored in a retrieval system, or transmitted in any form or by any means, mechanical, electronic, recording, or otherwise, without prior written permission of the creator of the podcast, Jay Allen.